Hi, everyone. Welcome to another lecture here at Precept Now. Today, we will be hearing from Dr. Heather Bayless. She has her DMP, and she is a nurse practitioner that specializes in oncology. So we're going to just start off kind of different today, not necessarily a lecture, but more so as an interview. And we're just going to talk more about oncology, different resources, and interesting things that she would like to share with us today. So, good afternoon. How are you doing, Dr. Bayless?
I'm well. How are you?
Well, very good. Well, tell us a little bit about yourself.
So, my name's Heather Bayless. I have been a nurse since 1999, nurse practitioner since 2015, and I have specialized in oncology and hematology since 2008. So I have experience on the inpatient side of hematology and oncology as an RN. And then my nurse practitioner experience has been outpatient. I hold master's and doctorate degrees from Duke University in nurse practitioner with a specialty in hematology oncology track. Also certified from City of Hope in California in cancer genetics and hereditary cancer risk assessment.
Wow, great. Those are some great accomplishments. Well, we are so grateful to have you today with us. So moving on to some other interesting things. I know you mentioned how you had gotten your specialty in oncology with your certificates. So how long specifically in only oncology have you been practicing as an NP?
Since 2016.
Great. So quite some time. And currently now, how big is your average patient panel that you would care for in the oncology setting, outpatient?
So that has varied. I've worked as an outpatient oncology NP in two different settings. And the first practice that I was associated with as a practice as a whole, we had over 1,000 patients, but that was over about 8 providers, you know, together shared that load. Currently, I see about 400 unique individuals.
Wow. And I know that you had mentioned your specific certificate that you had gotten for oncology. Are there others, or can you tell us a little bit more about what that is?
So my degree is adult gerontology nurse practitioner with a subspecialty in hematology and oncology. And then there is advanced oncology certified nurse practitioner, which is a certification available from the Oncology Nurses Credentialing Center.
Okay, wonderful. And what are some things or key points or pearls that you would recommend for novice providers to know about oncology?
There is a lot. We could spend a long time, and we'll probably, you know, it would be useful to divide this up into more than one conversation if people are interested in that. So an important thing to know is that from the oncology specialty standpoint, we rely on primary care to find the cancer in the first place before they get referred to oncology to discuss treatment options. So I think it's very important for new practitioners to know kind of the red flags of what to look for. And again, we're dealing with both hematology and oncology. There are red flags that you look for in the blood counts and blood chemistries, red flags that you would look for on physical exam and imaging in terms of solid tumor.
And like you said, that could be definitely multiple different lectures broken up because there are just so many that warrant further investigation. In particular, with just primary care with labs, where do you find the abnormalities that normally lead to more of your hematology abnormalities? Or what are the most common labs that you would still, like, I did not feel prepared in primary care coming on to interpret labs. I feel with basic things, yes. But then when you get into the whole white blood cell count differentials, and then if you were to do a peripheral smear, I feel like I was lost and very novice in that area. Still feel pretty new as well, interpreting some of those things. So I have to consult with Heather lots throughout the day at times.
Which, always glad to answer questions. Because I agree, you know, in my baseline, you know, adult NP courses that everybody was taking, our generalist courses, you didn't get a lot of background about that. And so what I learned came from the hematology and oncology sort of specialization end of my coursework.
Okay.
And so I agree, my family practice probably doesn't have that much training in it. As far as evaluating labs, I think the most important thing is to look at the trend for the individual over time. rather than what are you seeing on this particular lab readout. So if you're looking at a complete blood count, the first number at the top is going to be WBC, which is your total white blood cells. So you look at that number, and then you're going to skip down to where you have the percentages and then the absolute numbers of all of the different kinds of white blood cells. You're going to have your neutrophils, monocytes, eosinophils, lymphocytes, basophils. The total white blood cell number can give you some useful information, but that breakdown of the differential is going to give you some more information as to why that total white blood cell number is high, for example. You want to look at the percentages of the different types of white blood cells relative to each other, and then the absolute numbers of them, because they don't always necessarily match up. You know, you can have elevated percentages, but normal absolute numbers. So say, for example, if we're looking at an elevated white blood cell count, you're going to skip down, look at the differential. The first place my eyeballs go is the neutrophil number or the absolute neutrophil count. If that is elevated, they probably have some type of active infection. If that absolute neutrophil count is low, being below about 1.0 to 1.5, they're going to be neutropenic. They're going to be more prone to infection. We look at the total percentage of lymphocytes. A normal general rule of thumb, normal percentage of lymphocytes is going to be between 20 and 40% of the total white blood cells. If that number is higher, if you're getting up into 60, 70, 80% of your white blood cells are made up of lymphocytes, that's going to be a white flag to look for a chronic lymphocytic leukemia or CLL. If the lymphocytes are low, that can be a consequence of chronic viral infections. It's also a very common incidental finding in the COVID era that pretty much everybody who has ever had COVID or had a COVID vaccine is going to have a low lymphocyte count. And that's just something that we have noticed, you know, since COVID started. Monocytes. If monocytes are elevated, they could have a viral infection such as mononucleosis, Epstein-Barr virus. They could also have like an inflammatory condition anywhere in the body is going to make those monocytes go up. Eosinophils are elevated in allergy and some autoimmune processes. And also eosinophils tend to naturally be higher in the mornings than other times of the day. And a lot of times in the mornings is when we draw our fasted labs for primary care. Mm-hmm. So if those eosinophils are bumped up a little bit, I'm not usually worried about that. Okay, if they're not having any allergy type of symptoms associated with it. Eosinophils can also be high in parasitic infections, which we tend to think we live in America, things are clean, we don't have parasites. Yeah, we do. Mm-hmm. Particularly with some GI infections are actually parasitic infections, and that can make those eosinophils go up. Basophils can be elevated in autoimmune disease. And so people who have, for example, rheumatoid arthritis, things like that, you could see those basophils be high. So when you're looking at the breakdown of all of the different kinds of white blood cells, you're looking at that differential, you want to keep in the back of your mind, what are their other health conditions? Also, some medications, steroids, for example, make your white blood cells go up. Smoking makes your white blood cells go up. So you want to look at their health in general, and also what has their white blood cell count and their differential look like over time. For example, some people just naturally have a low neutrophil count. And I'm kind of making air quotes around my low there because you're looking at the reference ranges are what is considered average for a population. That being said, that population is going to change regionally. You know, within the United States, there's going to be differences in the blood counts. Some people naturally have lower neutrophil count. So genetically, that's just the way they're made. It's okay. They're not immunocompromised. You know, that's why you have to look back. And the more data you have over a longer period of time, data that you have, the better. So it can be frustrating sometimes for primary care to hear repeat CBC in 2-3 months. But you're just trying to gather more data points to see what is the baseline for this individual. If somebody's neutrophil count is always right around 1.0, they don't have any frequent infections, you know, there's no indication of any abnormal bone marrow process, they're okay. It's just the way they're made. So you have to look at what is normal for that person rather than that number is outside of this range that the computer has defined for you. Does that make sense?
Yes.
And I also wanted to talk a little more about the CBC, the value of a peripheral blood smear. The computerized automated differential can only give you information about the actual numbers and the percentages of the different types of white blood cells, for example, and also the number of the red blood cells and the size of the red blood cells. But when you get a peripheral blood smear and you look at them under the microscope, it gives you a lot more information. For example, is the red blood cell count low because some of the red blood cells have been broken up, either because of a mechanical heart valve or because of some enzyme deficiencies that can cause people to break down their red blood cells in response to stress or certain medications? Are the red blood cells too small or too large? Are they what they call hypochromic, you know, where they don't have a lot of color to them because they don't have much iron in them? Different vitamin deficiencies will make the red blood cells look different under the microscope. So there's a lot more information. You can look at the white blood cells, the lymphocytes, for example, and you can see, are they abnormal, not just in number, but are they abnormal in shape? And you can get some idea also about the function of the cells. Is there platelet clumping? Are the red blood cells clumping? All of these different things give you a lot more information and help you kind of solve the mystery of why you have that abnormal differential on a machine red blood count.
Wonderful. And I know in my setting, I have to specifically request a peripheral smear with the lab. Do you have to do the same, or do you actually look at it under the microscope yourself, or what's the process for your department?
I like to look at it under the microscope myself because I'm a nerd and I think it's fun.
Yeah.
But, you know, in order to get a specialist interpretation, I prefer to have it requested to be read by a pathologist in the lab.
Okay, wonderful. Well, thank you so much. These are great pearls for our complete blood count interpretation, because I know it is a whole nother world as we're talking about today. So thank you so much for that.
Thank you.
You know, just kind of going back to my own practice in primary care, when I first started doing my lab letters, it was like, oh, well, you know, saying everything's abnormal, that would be a scary lab letter to get. But in reality, you know, having a couple tenths of a point or being slightly right outside of the range, like you said, it is a, you know, normal auto-populated by our computer, but also with data that they, you know, gathered those averages and estimates for to be a quote unquote our normal values.
Right.
But yes, I do appreciate the fact that you're, you know, emphasizing looking at their individual history and establishing their baseline.
Yes.
Because so many times I will get something and say, well, I don't know about that. Let me look at that one again. So that I'm grateful for that. Thank you for touching base on that. And I know that we could talk in detail for hours probably on a lot of the different abnormalities with hematology and oncology and subsequently other follow-up procedures and events that happen with a new diagnosis or abnormalities that you're looking into. But what are some other resources that you would recommend to others to learn more about oncology, even for novice or seasoned practitioners? What do you suggest?
So the formatting on the particular site that I'm going to recommend is a little dense. It can be a little challenging to wade through. It's a lot of information, but I highly recommend the National Comprehensive Cancer Network, which is nccn.org. They provide all the information you could ever want. There will be guidelines for treatment of cancer by type. Okay, you have to log in. It's free, you know, to set up an account. And say, for example, if you suspect somebody has prostate cancer, you can click on prostate cancer and it will tell you how to work it up. And it will tell you when to consult urology, because urology manages a lot of prostate cancers, versus when to consult oncology, what lab tests to run, what imaging to do. And so from a primary care standpoint, you mostly need the diagnosis end of that, or the workup end of that, because then it also gets into a lot of detail about how to treat all of the different cancers depending on the subtypes. So again, that's the National Comprehensive Cancer Network, nccn.org. It's an excellent resource for you know, I have this abnormality in imaging or labs or what have you. Now what? How do I work it up? I'm also a big fan of Family Practice Notebook, which is fpnotebook.com. So it is a website and also an app. And it will tell you again, you know, if this is what you suspect, here's how to do the initial workup in labs. For hematology, a great resource is the American Society of Hematology, which is hematology.org. There are clinical practice guidelines, and I think a helpful resource on that site from a primary care standpoint is anticoagulation management. So there are evidence-based, you know, it has references to clinical trials, comparing head-to-head different anticoagulants, looking at family history, different bleeding and clotting disorders, how to work that up if you suspect that there's a familial process going on there. Again, that's hematology.org for the American Society of Hematology Clinical Practice Guidelines. Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, LLS.org, is a great resource for if you suspect that somebody has a leukemia or a lymphoma or even some of the other blood disorders that sometimes people aren't as familiar with, such as MGUS, one of my personal favorites, monoclonal gammopathy of undetermined significance.
Wow, that's a mouthful.
I know, isn't it great? I can even spell it.
Okay, great.
So Waldenstrom's macroglobulinemia, you know, wow. All of these blood disorders that people may not be as familiar with. Leukemia Lymphoma Society, LLS.org, great resource to look up about those. Something I just found out was available is educator modules on the Advanced Practitioner Society for Hematology and Oncology. And that is APSHO.org. These educator modules are PowerPoint slide decks, which were initially developed for people who are teaching nurse practitioner or physician assistant students, but also very helpful for people who are already in practice to get brushed up on, you know, hematology and oncology disorders, you know, from initial workup through to how do you treat it.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. What advice would you give to someone who is just a student? They know they want to go the NP route. They decided that oncology, hematology is where they would like to end up being one day in the work field. What would be some good advice for during school or just going along your path, getting to the final goal of the oncology or hematology NP setting? I know that's kind of a broad.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yeah, I know it's kind of a broad. But at least just kind of going out, like, what were some things that helped you get through school? What were some things that helped to motivate you other than just the resources to get you to your goal? Like, what made you, Dr. Bayless, say, I know oncology is where I want to be. Like, I know that's where I want to practice. Was it a personal experience or was it just your desire?
And that's something that I found is almost all of my colleagues, you know, the whole time I've been in oncology, 15 years, have had personal experience either themselves or a family member or friends or even patients that they've taken care of in the hospital. Somebody has made an impact on them to the point where they say, yes, I want to make a difference for people who are in similar situations. So while you're in school, I would definitely recommend being enrolled in a program that has that hematology oncology subspecialty so that you get that perspective in addition to your primary care training, because that is going to help a lot rather than coming out with a, you know, family nurse practitioner and then having to learn all of the hematology and oncology on top of it while you're working. That is tremendously overwhelming.
That has been my experience.
Yes.
Along with a lot of other things.
Yes.
It feels like, you know, we kind of learn so much about all these different specialties as medicine is so specialized now. So primary care is, if you think about it, it's most likely like the med-surg of nursing. If you think about bedside nursing, you kind of handle everything.
Yes.
Jack of all, master of some. But for the most part, we rely heavily on specialty providers like yourself to help guide us and educate us for the next steps and where to go with what we're finding in our labs and our clinical findings. Mm-hmm. One other interesting question that I thought of asking you was, what is the best way to relay bad news? to people with, you know, new diagnosis of terminal cancers or with poor prognosis? How do you recommend going about that to give the diagnosis, you know, face-to-face or over the phone?
I try to avoid over the phone as much as possible, because even as you're working with people who have cancer throughout the years, they always remember that conversation. A lot of them will tell you, you know, they'll say, he didn't even take the time to tell me in person. I just got this as a phone call. And they can tell you what they were doing when that phone call came and how devastating that was. So I would definitely recommend preparing for the worst and hoping for the best. You know, even as you're going through the workup, if you initially suspect something, you know, could be a cancerous lesion on a CT, for example, tell the patient that. Tell them there are many things it could be. It could be cancer. It could be scarring. It could be infection. We don't know, but it's hard because you don't want them to be worried about it to the point where that's in the front of their brain all the time and they can't function until they get their test result back. And that does happen, and that's very understandable. You want to prepare them, first of all, for that possibility that it could be cancer. Reassure them that you're doing everything that is, you're using all of the tools available to find out as quickly as possible whether it is cancer or not. And let them know that there's going to be a lot of testing and a lot of appointments available to get all that information. And then when you have your answers, carve out time to provide that answer in person and expect them to cry. You know, have tissues there, have drinks, have, you know, recommend that they bring a support person to that appointment that you're expecting to give the results and make time for it. That can be very, very challenging in primary care, especially if you're in a setting where you have 15-minute office visits. You may have to rearrange your schedule a little bit, and that's okay. There are some follow-up appointments that aren't as urgent. See if you can move them to a different part of the day or another day that same week. Block 3 or 4 appointment spots. Block out 45 minutes or an hour to sit with this person and their support person and provide that information in a compassionate way. Provide them written information to take home, because they're not going to remember a word you say after the word cancer. You know, provide them written information, including what the next steps are going to be in terms of, you know, we say, for example, we have this new diagnosis of lung cancer. The next step is going to be to see the oncologist or the surgeon or radiation oncology, or probably all three. So who are those people? You know, write down for them, this is the doctors that are going to be seeing you next, and here is why they're going to see you. Because it's very overwhelming. Don't be afraid to be human. It's better if you're human. I can't tell you how many people I've cried with, and they appreciate that. You know, it's kind of a cliche that people won't remember what you know, but they'll remember how you made them feel. That's absolutely the truth. And so it's important for them to know that they matter to you and that you're going to do the best you can to take care of them.
Wow. Well, I can tell you are a provider that is full of heart and knowledge. So I'm so grateful to learn this from you today.
Thank you.
So this is Laura Love with Precept Now, and I have with me today Dr. Heather Bayless, who has shared some insights on oncology, and hopefully we'll have some supporting information below for you to click on and get to a lot of the resources that she discussed. So we hope that you have a wonderful day, and we'll see you next time on the next talk session.
Yes, all right. Thank you so much
for inviting
me.
You have a wonderful day.
You too.
Okay. Bye, guys.